Okay, so I'm Rick Hansen. It's April 22nd, 2015. And as I do sometimes, before I kind of get into my major spiel with discussion, I just want to see if there are any questions about meditation. But before even doing that, I noticed that as soon as we closed that door, it started getting stuffy again in this room. Is it kind of, maybe we could crack it a little bit, or unless you're freezing back there. We want to be considerate for those in the back of the room who are in the middle of the wind tunnel. That happens if you open that door a couple inches, you're on it. All right, great. Let's see, any questions about meditation? You notice my instructions or suggestions or anything about that? I talked about letting go and opening into, or anything else? Yeah, please.
Yeah, I've been having the experience of, for a while, of partway through meditation, I'll get really, really hot. And I don't think it has to do with the temperature in the room, because it happens other places as well.
Yeah.
And then I just sit with it, and it goes away.
Interesting.
So, and I don't think it's a hot flash.
Yeah.
So I don't know. Is that?
I don't know. In general, I've noticed that for myself. If I start moving sometimes into pretty concentrated states, I'll start feeling warmer, and the neuropsychologist in me wonders plausibly if the sympathetic wing of the nervous system, that kind of is involved with, you know, the heart beats speeding up, and also involved with inhaling and kind of energy or intensity. I wonder sometimes if that's getting in the mix. I wonder about that. Otherwise, I don't know, and I suspect. Also, you know, it's interesting, if we were to take your basal body temperature at that point, would you actually be hotter? Or is there a perception thing that's going on? And you know, kind of related to that, which relates to the topic I'm going to get into, if you do a little experiment with me right now, imagine that you're looking out here through a hula hoop, as it were, about that wide, you know, maybe 3 feet or so wide, right? You're aware of your visual field. Right? And I suspect that for you, what's inside the center of your visual field is in color, right? And outside the hula hoop, as it were, the circle of, you know, 3 feet or so across, is also in color. Except the interesting thing is that in terms of producing color, the rods and cones in your retina and so forth that send the color signals and information and the wavelengths and so forth to your brain are only in the center of the visual field. That sense of color outside the center of the visual field is CG'd, computer graphics. Virtual reality. The brain just paints it in. Really? It's kind of stunning, isn't it? Yeah, it's really quite remarkable. So there's a lot about moment-to-moment experiencing that is constructed. And as one of the benefits of bringing some neuroscience into contemplative practice is you start realizing how much of moment-to-moment experience is just kind of made up. And that helps you take it less seriously. Right, and become increasingly, you know, lighter about it and detached about it, and also grateful for this extraordinary movie that we're just kind of in the middle of. Amazing. So who knows? Heat might be a doorway into that as well. Anything about what to do with your attention, what to do with breathing, what to do with focusing? Short, sweet questions, then I'm going to move on. Yeah.
I find myself going in so many different places when I go.
Yeah.
You know, I'm thinking about a coat of paint to put on a tricycle that I have.
Yeah.
You know, and I really liked it when you said to visualize a sound.
Okay, yeah.
Here you said visualize a sound, and I visualized that bell doing its wah, 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 wah,
yeah.
Wah, wah, wah. And I found that focusing on that helped me quiet all the, you know, projects that I've not got completed.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I just wanted to comment on that. That was one tool that, you know, visualizing a sound where I'm not even thinking about the sound. I'm just visualizing the sound, which, I don't know, sounds very cool.
Yeah, actually it does. Yeah, thank you.
And that really helped me just calm down and be able to, and it's kind of like I was focused, but I wasn't focused.
Right.
So I don't know. I just want to.
No, it's great stuff.
Comment.
Yeah, thank you for saying that. And it's so important to realize that, you know, I think that a lot of meditative training was developed by stone introverts, really chill, mellow, kind of naturally inert people who could just breath and go, wow. They like look at a stone, wow, stone, you know, like for hours. And they go, okay, you want to meditate, you want to be happy, and they get happy, that's their deal, right? They get eventually really, really happy, and people go, how'd you do it, man? And you go, well, just look at a stone for an hour. That's what I did. And then other people look at the stone, you know, and they're like, oh, I can't stand the stone, I want to kick the stone. I want the stone to move, you know, boring, right? And then, like, they feel, like, bad. Oh, get out of the temple. You don't belong here. You can't just look at a stone. And the thing is, some people are, like, stone lookers. But most of us are, like, dancers. And we got to move around, especially in modern life, too. So it's really important to not get uptight about these methods, you know. And if anybody was for that, it was the Buddha. He said, try this, try that. You know, do this, do that. Make it real. You know, keep it interesting. Keep it alive for you. Because if it gets all sterile and dead, it's not going to have the juice that keeps you going and wakes you up and opens you up and keeps you interested and motivated. So I think it's super cool to try different methods, and especially methods that are more stimulating. You know, because paradoxically, a little story, I had a client whose son was autistic, and she discovered when he was about 10 months old, after he basically was awake for 10 months, which drove her insane for 10 months, this infant boy, that she had to buy a television, put it in his room, turn it to Nickelodeon something, the Disney Channel, I don't know, leave it on 24 hours a day, and then he could sleep. It's a paradox of finding those objects for your attention to rest that are stimulating enough that enable your attention to rest there so the rest of you can kind of quiet around that. And so find that it will work, like moving. Yeah, I want to say more.
I have a comment on that. Yeah. I have a really like busy, overactive, passionate sort of thing going on with me. Yeah. And I find that sometimes I get into these states and it's like a hyper-focused.
Yeah.
Where I'm focusing on something and it feels so great. Like it could even be like standing in an aisle at the store and I'm just focusing on one visual word, not even reading the word, but just the visual of it.
Yeah.
And I can sit there for like 10 minutes and stare at that through all the busyness of me and my Mikey-isms.
Yeah.
That hyper-focused state, I love it. I yearn for it.
Yeah.
Because it's so calming. But it's like my brain has to have all this other things going on, and then all of a sudden it locks into this. Every blue moon, I'll be in that state.
Yeah. Now, isn't that really interesting? That it's like your version of the TV on, you know?
Yeah.
Having all that stuff, you know, or, you know, like being aware of the whole body while breathing. Or opening your eyes to just take in the whole room, be with the whole room, you know? Breathe a little faster. Weirdly enough, you know, think about something, the things that make you happy, like, wow, let's just kind of hang with gratitude for 45 minutes, you know, one thing after another. That's okay. The trick, of course, is to find that place where it's actually working for you and you're not just planning your vacation, right? Because that's easy. We can do that anytime. This is sanctuary. And that's another thing to say for yourself, you know, right now, I can worry about that in 22 minutes, right? 17 minutes to go. Or I can plan that then, or I can figure out what I'm going to say to her in 18 minutes. Now this is my special time, right? Because it's special to roll in here, bunch of people, here you got here, it's quiet. There is a certain fundamental, in my view, sacredness. There's an offering, certainly, a sanctuary. Make use of it. So there's that part, right? But on the other hand, not be uptight or grinding on ourselves just because we can't stare at a stone for 45 minutes straight. Really important. Okay. I'm going to move on. That's it. Meditation. See, there you had it. That was it. Are you guys okay with that? Maybe I'll do a night where I just do meditation because a lot of comes out of that. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Yeah, that would be good. I'll do that really soon. Okay? Okay, good. So, I want to read you one of the more well-known passages in the Buddhist teaching stream from the Dhammapada, and you've come across this or heard this probably in different translations. So I want to offer it and then kind of comment on it and see what you think about it. Okay? So the passage says, mind precedes all things. Mind is their chief, mind is their maker. If one speaks or does a deed with a mind that is pure within, happiness then follows along like a never departing shadow. Okay? There's a variation of this that comes next that starts, mind precedes all things, mind is their chief, mind is their maker. If one speaks or does a deed with a mind that is impure within, unhappiness then follows along like a never departing shadow. So it goes both ways. Tonight I'm going to focus on the happiness part. All right? So you recall that passage. It's a pretty profound passage. You know, basically the emphasis there is, you know, our mental attitudes, our point of view, our emotional state, our perspective, our the ways we see relationships, you know, our intentions, that really affects things a lot. And I want to make a comment and then make it practical. So the first comment is that sometimes this passage is taken to mean that the Buddha thought that there was no stone or wall or objective reality. And as best we can gather, you know, 2,500 years ago or so, he didn't think that way at all. You know, he didn't think that this stuff, reality, was just sort of made up. It's not like mind is making up material reality, okay? The first thing. It might, all right? I don't think that's the case myself, but this passage doesn't mean that the Buddha thought that everything exists only in our own imagination. Okay? Second, I want to raise basically four questions about your own mind that kind of cut to the chase. The first question is, does your mind deep down lean toward development, learning, growth? A lot of people don't have a mind in which they're motivated fundamentally to grow, to make use of life's experiences, you know, to go to bed a little wiser than when they woke up, or, you know, when the next New Year's Eve rolls around, to be a little wiser than they were the year before at that time, a little happier, a little more insightful, a little more capable, a little more competent internally and externally. Some people have that as their mind. Some people don't. And I just kind of invite you into that question. You know, one of the, you know, for me, really important things in my own life, beginning when I was, you know, pretty young, was this realization that nobody could stop me from learning. They could screw with me in a lot of other ways, and they did sometimes, but they couldn't stop me from learning. But only I could learn for myself. No one could make me learn. No one could insert learning in my head. You know, I was responsible for my own learning, broadly defined, including emotional, psychological, social, interpersonal, motivational, spiritual learning. So I just invite you into this consideration as you move through your day. To what extent is there a leaning into learning? Learning from the experience, taking in what's useful, putting in correction, learning more about other people, learning who you can't trust, learning who you can trust, you know, learning what works, right? Learning what happens when you stop at two cookies or two beers, learning what happens when you go to six cookies or beers, you know, learning, okay? Leaning into learning. What is the case there? Second question is, around practicing with experience in the moment. I had a session with a client recently. I'm a therapist, and she's very knowledgeable about her own psychology, her own childhood, you know, abusive experiences she had, tough situations. She's very aware of it and has a lot of insight into why she feels the way she does. She could write a master's thesis, right, on her own neurosis, okay? And she was telling me this whole long, you know, kind of long story about roughly about, you know, several really difficult days in which she had a lot of emotional reactions to one thing after another. And the question on the table was not, you know, do you understand what the relationship is between what you're feeling today and your past? The question was, what are you going to do about the anger, the fear, the breakdown in your relationships, the feeling unentitled to your own needs being met, the shame inside from seeing others who were like you as a kid, you know, as for example. You know, what are you going to do with those reactions? Like, okay, stimulus response, got it. You understand the relationship between the stimulus and the response, things that happened or other people or situations she was in, but what are you going to do now with all that? Are you going to practice with it? What's your practice? Are you going to try to, you know, let go of what's painful for yourself or, you know, impairing you in your relations with others? Are you going to try to deliberately grow good things inside yourself as a matter of practice? Are you going to deliberately try to kind of calm down some of your emotional reactions or manage some of your impulses? How are you going to practice? And the trick, of course, is to engage that question not in any kind of nanny, nanny, nanny way, but in a very genuine way, right? What are we going to practice? What will we do with what has arisen right now? Right? And that's the second kind of question about mind preceding all things. Mind is the chief. Mind is their maker. Do you lean into practice, particularly over the course of a day? Is that your habit? Is that your inclination? And is there anything you could do to strengthen that, to make, you know, to shorten the period of time in real time between getting upset and starting to practice with being upset, right? I mean, hey, if it's a day later, a year later, that's better than nothing and is better than many, right? Is it an hour later? That's getting pretty good. You know, is it 10 minutes after you got plugged in? Is it a minute? Is it 10 seconds? Is it real time? You know, bringing that in and having that real time practicing with what's arising, getting more and more into real time. Right? It's inclination, the leaning into practice. Okay? That's a key question. That really, you know, shades mind one way or another, this chief, this maker. And so third question is, are you leaning into love? Are you taking the extra few seconds to move past just tracking that there's a face there of a certain gender, certain age, certain race, whatnot, characteristics, and moving into, wow, there's a person in there. There's a being behind those eyes. There's someone who, you know, likes those cookies, doesn't like those toothaches, you know, someone who worries about their kids, is okay with dying themselves, but doesn't want their children to die, right? There's a real person over there, person just like over here, who's affected by things. And so that question in terms of the nature of mind, is there a leaning into love? Doesn't mean letting people abuse you or use you, but is there an inclination, you know, a kind of leaning into kindness, compassion, you know, wishing well, trying to be helpful rather than hurtful, trying to see the good in the other, you know, kind of a blessing disposition. I had a spiritual teacher for a while called it that. Are we oriented around kind of wishing well, having kindness, you know, toward others? Is that the inclination of the mind? Right. So those are the three I wanted just to name kind of concretely, right? Matter-of-factly, is there a leaning into learning? Is there a leaning into practice? Is there a leaning into love? And they help each other. This may seem kind of abstract, but it gets very real. You know, what's your intention over the course of the day with regard to learning, getting the value from your experiences over the course of the day? Right? There's a term in psychology, you know, they'll run these rats through mazes, they call them trials, right? And, you know, there's cheese down some tunnels, little puff of annoying air down another tunnel, you know, a hot fellow rat down another tunnel, right? And then you're like, how do you just learn to go down those tunnels rather than the puff of annoying air tunnels? And some rats take forever to learn. Some humans too. On the other hand, there's some rats and some people that are one trial learners. Right? They get it. Like, oh yeah, aha, got it. Lesson learned. You know, implemented. Not going to do that again. Or aha, from now on, I got it. You know, okay. So that can be our orientation over a day, leaning into learning, right? Also, leaning into practice. Just calling ourselves to practice, seeing ourselves as a sincere practitioner, realizing that one of the best forms of dana, generosity, we can offer to others is our personal commitment to practice. To taking responsibility for our reactions, recognizing how they're, you know, stimulated by many factors, but still fundamentally, they're happening inside us. We are the final common pathway of the causes streaming through us to make this moment of experience, which then moves into, you know, deeds of thought and word and action. Is our orientation fundamentally that I'm a practitioner, and because I'm a practitioner, that's my best gift to other people. And then, of course, you know, are we leaning into open-heartedness? Is our natural lean into open-heartedness? We deal with what we need to deal with if they mess with us, let's say, to the extent that you can track what I'm saying in kind of a slang way. But, you know, in general, is there a leaning into love? Okay. And then the last thing I want to bring up is more, I think, profound and harder to talk about. And it's something that's routinely pointed to, so I want to just call it out. And if you listen to the words here, it's really interesting. If one speaks or does a deed with a mind that is pure within, happiness then follows along like a never-departing shadow. And there is a sense that many, many people talk about, write about. I think just about everybody actually has inside themselves. There is a sense that there actually already is a kind of layer of mind that is already pure within. And the trick a lot in life is to ground in it and come from it. You know, it's kind of like a sense of something still or quiet or spacious, or it feels almost impersonal. It's not particularly male or female, you know, Rick or Bob or Sally, right? It's just, some people call it consciousness, beingness. What is that? Some people would say that sense most people have, perhaps everyone has, of a kind of layer, like, or a quality or a background. I think of it sometimes as the wallpaper of mind, something. Maybe it is some infusion into this realm, this mind of something transcendental. Don't know. Inside the frame, though, of material reality, the natural frame, the focus of science, and so forth, what could possibly be the basis for that funny, very powerful sense of a kind of place of quiet, stillness, through which experience flows somehow, or in the space of which experience, hearing, seeing, thinking, feeling, wanting, arises and passes away? I suspect that neurologically what that is the kind of background resting fertile noise of the neural substrates of consciousness that are just kind of waiting to represent something. And because it's stable, right, that background noise, if you will, has a quality of stillness to it. It doesn't change. Change moves through it. It's kind of like moving patternings of stillness, right? So what helps us, whatever it actually is caused by, and I also think it has to do with the architecture of the nervous system, basically, without getting real super technical, is you have like a level, and then there's kind of an indexing of what's happening at that level, And then there's an indexing of what's happening at that level, kind of all the way up. And there are ways in which the nervous system is very integrative, resting in the body as a whole. There's a sense of wholeness. So maybe that too supports this sense of stillness, of spaciousness, you know, of peacefulness, kind of an innate place of peace inside everyone. Whatever it is, okay, there are a couple things that are really practical for, as is traditionally advised, really across so many traditions, to deepen our access and accessibility to this place inside ourselves and come more and more from it. And I want to name two in particular. Okay? One is the sense of the body as a whole. There's something about getting a sense of the whole body that takes us into a sense of integration and wholeness. You can practice it in meditation to just kind of try to keep getting a sense of the body as a whole. There's a whole body. You can get a sense of the skin, you know, all the way around you. You can also get a sense of including every sensation in your body at once as you breathe, you know, as if the spotlight of attention is really wide. I think you'll find that if you do that, you'll have more of a sense of things as a whole, you know, with a kind of stable stillness. So I invite you into that in your practice. And you can see what happens. Because if you think of it, when we're agitated, usually attention is kind of condensed to just one thing, you know. Whereas when we get quieter or more at peace, we tend to go into a sense of wholeness and allness. So there's that. And then the other thing I would suggest is disengaging from inner language. Easier said than done. But you just kind of notice when you're caught up in that stream and the voices and the conversations and the points of view, right? It's hard to have that sense of underlying stillness, spaciousness, peace, right? Impersonal. Because when we're chattering away, there's a lot of me making and I making. Right? So how do we do that? One way to do that is to find something to focus on that's not verbal, like physical sensations, breathing, emotion, those are physical sensations, or other things besides physical sensation like emotion, like gratitude or loving kindness or compassion, focusing on that. Another thing, honestly, is to just kind of disengage from the chatter. You know, just become less and less interested in it and intend for your own mind to be quieter. As we do that, we have more and more access to that sense of spacious stillness. And that becomes more and more, you know, the habit of our mind. Okay. All right. What do you think about all that? Right? Quick review, leaning into learning, practice, love, and spaciousness.
Unbearable. And with working with my therapist, what I did is I reframed this guy from, you know, my boyfriend to my teacher. And when
learning orientation.
Yes. And when I think of him as, so his role is to create this situation for me where I can be learning how to work with the anxiety, learning how to quiet and soothe myself, rather than just getting angry that he's not being the way I want him to be, you know, and making things easier. I found that to be really, really helpful reframe for me of taking me into the quiet place that you've been talking about.
Well, that's great. Thank you. Great. Other people? Learning? Okay, great.
Well, just a comment. I was really struck by your awareness early on in life that no one could stop you from learning. And it just seems to me what a powerful thing to say to a young child. Number one, because every child knows that something sacred that can't be taken away from them.
Yeah.
And it's also a paradoxical learning for a child.
Okay, well, thank you for saying that. Yeah, you know, that's right. The man may have your body, your money, right? Your land, but the man never gets to have your mind unless you give it to him. And you know the way I'm using that word, the man, right? The authority figures, the parents, the coaches, the bullies in the schoolyard, whatever, you know, the culture, the dictators. They may get all those other things, but deep in your private secret sanctuary, your mind is your own, if you claim it. Yeah.
I've been reading Marianne Williams' book, Return to Love, and I hope I can convey what she was saying very closely to what she said, although I'm not sure.
Yeah.
She has a feisty part of her, and she's opinionated.
Yeah.
But she was explaining how, you know, she says how in relationships, of course with men and women, we're different. And we have to expect that we're going to come up against places in the other person that may not be in harmony with our own. But if we can come from love rather than critique or embattlement or judgment, just that we're here, if we could just know that our job is to love ourselves. Huh? You know, you throw the dice in any kind of relationship, you know, even buying bobby pins, you know. This, you may not be happy with them.
Yeah.
But if we can learn that we're all these beautiful beings, and what works is love.
Oh, thank you. Beautiful way to say that. Yeah, thank you very much for saying that. Yeah. Other comments about leaning into learning, practice, love, or kind of spaciousness? Yeah, in the back there.
I actually agree with this lady that just said about leaning into love. However, the thing that I was confused about, and I'm being very careful because now I'm also, first you have to love yourself, and regardless who else is beside you, whether it's a relationship or anything else, how you are inside reflects on the outside. So you're actually, it's like, you know, you're contagious. If you're angry, you project that on somebody else. So I've been doing the scanning up and down, and I do the Gwonki, the donkey method.
Sure.
Method of Nambiohorende Kyo. But the thing is, Rick, I get a little confused because they say, be very careful. You know, I don't want to get ahead of myself because, you know, you can learn so much and how smart is that? It's like the simplest things, you know, are going into nothingness because, you know, then you're chasing with your brain. Like you just said, the guy on the horse was running after, he says, where are you going with your energy? So the thing that I'm trying to do is because they say, you know, even a meditator, a practitioner could elaborate on how the person, what method, because there's, you know, the Japanese methods and all of the Bianchi, and there's all the different types of methods of which one you should go into on meditating.
Uh-huh.
However, you know, being a beginner and also being, you know, I study pretty good. I'm not trying to be mean, but I actually like results. To open up to lovingness, because I have a trouble having that open heart thing. So that's what I'm saying. Is it better not to incorporate the dialogue? It's probably better not to. You're saying focus, like for example, if I was to do a whole long day class, I may have trouble, you know, really meditating. I don't like pretending because then it doesn't do any good for me. So, but as far as going further, one aspect at a time, right, on that. The chanting part, right?
Right. So a couple things there. First, I think like I was saying earlier, finding what works for a person. I mean, chanting, for example, across so many traditions has been really useful for people. I remember doing the fire walk once with Tony Robbins, literally. You know, it was really funny. I was in San Francisco a long time ago, and you know, big hotel, a lot of people. Initially, I thought, he's a cool guy, I like him, but you know, no way am I going to do this fire walk. Are you insane? And then around, and he was kind of saying, don't worry, I'm hypnotizing everybody in the room, and when I hypnotize you, you'll be safe. Don't worry. And internally, I was thinking, hell with you, buddy. You're not going to hypnotize me, right? And then about 11:30 at night, I said, okay, I'm going to try it. What the heck? And then after that, I was, hypnotize me, please. So anyway, so I'm not sure he hypnotized me, but so we do the fire walk, and he has you do this little saying, cool moss, right? And okay. So, man, have you ever done that firework? I don't know. Anybody else has? Yeah. So I was doing cool moss, cool moss, cool moss. That was my personal chant. So chanting, you know, obviously many people chant. On the other hand, some people find, as I do at this point, that the verbalness of it actually draws me into a verbal place that I'm more and more interested, partly because I use language a lot during the day in my work anyway, you know, to pull out of it. So find what works for you. That's on the one hand. On the other hand, make sure that your practice, how can I put it, that it's useful for you, that it's moving you forward rather than holding you back. And sometimes the practices we like actually hold us back because we stagnate in them. So, you know, that's the thing to be careful about, I think. The other thing to stress the point and kind of make it simple is to really, all this stuff for me, most of it, it basically boils down to being. How comfortable are we being for the duration of one exhalation? You know, or just being while another person is talking. Right? How capable are we to kind of be? And in some ways, when we meditate, we build up our muscle of being. We train in being. We develop our capacity to be. And we do that in part by disciplining ourselves and restraining our habit of doing. And we interrupt the habit of doing. So there's space to strengthen being, in part. And then we draw on different methods like chanting or mindfulness of breathing or, you know, practicing loving kindness that kind of help us. And then increasingly, we become more stable in our ability to be and just be. And then more and more, which is what I was trying to get at in that fourth aspect here of, you know, the mind, more and more we start to experience being as the space of doing, the space of thinking, that, and the being has a kind of peaceful stability to it, which enables us as we rest in it more and more, our seat in it, root in it more and more, it enables us to become more and more unattached to what's flowing through the mind. Because we're full with being. You know, you think about so much of what we do with doing is we do doing to get to being, but our doingness is constantly obliterating our beingness. Right? It's making it impossible to have it. And through practicing in being, you become more and more being. I don't know how to put it. You just are being inside of what you're thinking as needed. You're planning, you're negotiating, you're doing what you do. But there's this background feeling of being, which has a very embodied quality to it. It's like your body is going on being. And when that happens, it undoes tons of anxiety because a lot of fear. The great early child psychiatrist Winnicott talked about, you know, the primacy of the infant's experience of going on being. That without going on being, whether you're an infant or, you know, an aging adult, it's terrifying. Whereas if you have some sense of stability of going on being, you become, you know, fear just falls away. And, you know, what's in the mind in the moment doesn't seem like a problem. It's something to do with or practice with or deal with, but the problem orientation to experience gradually falls away as we kind of open out into and rest more and more in being. And that's what our practice a lot is about. It's not the entirety of it, but it's a lot of it. And people that are really, really far along, you just kind of see what they're like. You look in their eyes or faces, they're just being, you know. And they're being while writing a memo or listening to you or answering a question or eating their oatmeal. But really, all that is just kind of, all that activity is happening in a space of stillness. Let's sit with this for a minute and wrap it up, okay? Thanks. Thanks a lot. Very attentive. Thank you. Be well.